Brother Roger has asked that we read together Genesis chapter 49, verses 5, 6, and 7, and I will read those. Genesis chapter 49, verses 5, 6, and 7. Simeon and Levi are brethren. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. O my soul, come not thou into their secret, unto their assembly. Mine honor be not thou united. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they dig down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob, and scatter them in Israel. Brothers and sisters, Brother Roger Lewis will be speaking this evening, and his address is entitled, Learning to Respond Wisely to Trial, The Story of Simeon and Levi. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good evening, my dear brothers and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. In the study tonight, we're going to look at the story of those brief but, shall we say, memorable verses in Genesis chapter 49 and verses 5 to 7, when we read the story here of Simeon and Levi, and in fact, the blessing, so it is, that their father brought upon them. We might ask the question, actually, in terms of the beginning of our study this evening, why was it indeed that Simeon and Levi were in fact blessed together, as you may have noticed in these verses? In fact, you see what it does say, because if you come to verse 1 of Genesis chapter 49, do you see what it says? It says that Jacob called his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. Just tuck those words away, that which shall befall you in the last days. And then he says, gather yourselves together and hear, ye sons of Jacob. Verse 2, and hearken unto Israel your father. And then at the end of the blessings, it says this in verse 28 of Genesis 49, says, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is that their father spake unto them and blessed them. Every one, according to his blessing, he blessed them. And so he did. He blessed each son. But he didn't bless Simeon and Levi separately, like all the other sons. For some reason, he blessed them together. And that's really the burden of our study tonight, to try and discover why it was and what lesson we might learn from that enigma in the story of the blessing of Jacob upon his sons in Genesis 49. See what it says in verse 5. Simeon and Levi, says the record, are brethren. Well, why would it say that they're brethren? Because all 12 sons of Jacob were brethren, surely. And Simeon and Levi were simply, in fact, brethren because they were the sons of Leah, but so also were Reuben and Judah and Issachar and Zebulun. They were the direct brethren of Simeon and Levi. Why just these two described as brethren? And why are they joined together in such a way that Jacob will address their spirit and their destiny with one single prophecy? And what a strange blessing it was. It sounds more like a curse, doesn't it, brothers and sisters? Verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brethren, instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. Verse 7, cursed be their anger. It sounds more like a blessing than a curse, which it was. Well, I think this story begins a little before Genesis chapter 49. If you come back to Genesis chapter 34, you might recall that there is that rather terrible story of Dinah. Now, Dinah was actually the daughter of Leah, and therefore she was the sister of Reuben and Judah and Simeon and Levi. She was their direct sister. And so when the matter of Genesis 34 happened, And we're told that there was going to come about, as it were, the avenging of Dinah. This was a matter of direct interest to her own brothers, who in fact include Simeon and Levi, the sons of Leah. See what it says in Genesis 34, verse 13. It says, "And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, deceitfully, and said," because he had defiled Dinah, their sister, "and they said unto them, we cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach unto us. But in this will we consent unto you, if ye will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised, then will we give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people." But verse 13 says that the sons of Jacob had answered deceitfully. Do you know, it wasn't all the brothers that answered deceitfully, it was just two. Only two sons answered deceitfully. And we know that because verse 24 says, "And unto Hamor and unto Shechem his son hearkened all that went out of the gate of his city, and every male was circumcised, and all that went out of the gate of his city. And it came to pass on the third day, when they were sore, that two of the sons of Jacob," not all of them, just two of the sons of Jacob. Why? "Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. They slew Hamor and Shechem's son with the edge of the sword. They took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went out. And these sons of Jacob, these two came upon the slain and spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their sheep and their oxen and their asses, which was in the city, and all their wealth, all their little ones, their wives. And they spoiled even all that was in the house." And the record here is clear that Simeon and Levi were the instigators of the violence and most probably the only ones involved. And not only did they slay the men, they slew the city and they took their families and their flocks and their herds and their wealth, and they used their swords to wreak devastation and revenge. And Jacob was terribly upset about it, because Jacob says in verse 30 to Simeon and Levi, "Ye have troubled me to make me stink among the inhabitants of the land, and now I shall be destroyed." And you see how they answer their father in verse 31, these two, Simeon and Levi. They said, "Should he deal with our sister as with an harlot?" They were not at all repentant. They challenged their father disrespectfully. Oh yes, these two sons were vigorous and violent. They were brethren, all right. But they were brethren in evil. They weren't brethren in good. And now come to Genesis chapter 37, which, although it's two or three chapters later, we believe was probably less than 2 years later, after the circumstance of Genesis chapter 34. We say that because it appears that Dinah and Joseph were born close to one another in time, and that Joseph is going to be 17 in Genesis 37, and Dinah was probably something of that age back in chapter 34. So chapter 37 follows pretty well hard on the heels chronologically of the circumstances of chapter 34. And this episode, well, let's see what it says. It says in verse 15 that a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field, Joseph. And the man asked him, saying, "What seekest thou?" And he said, "I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks." And we're told that the man said to him, "Well, they're departed from hence. I heard them say, let us go to Dothan." And so Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. And when they saw him come afar, before he even came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. Now you see where it says there in verse 18 and verse 19 that they conspired and they said, "Behold, this dreamer cometh." In the Targum of Jonathan, we're told this, if I can just get my slide to work, we're told this in the Targum of Jonathan, which is a commentary upon this episode. It says, "And they saw him afar off before he had come nigh to them, and plotted against him to kill him. And Simeon and Levi, who were brothers in council, said each man to his brother, behold, this master of dreams cometh. And now, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits and say that an evil beast hath devoured him, and we will see what will be the interpretation of his dreams. Now the question is, why would the Targum of Jonathan single out Simeon and Levi as the speakers and the instigators in this episode in Genesis chapter 37? Well, I think there's good reason. You notice where they were, by the way? It says in verse 12 that they'd gone to feed their father's flock near Shechem. But Shechem is the city that they had just destroyed in Genesis chapter 34, probably less than a couple of years ago. What are they doing back there? What are they doing taking their flocks near to Shechem when their father Jacob was scared of reprisals? See, I think they're back there to assert their domination in the area, in which case we can be certain that fierce and angry Simeon and Levi were dominant. And if they were there, then no doubt they probably had their swords with them at the time. So when the record says in verse 18, "Let us slay him," and again verse 20, "Let us slay him," they could have dispatched Joseph probably then and there if they chose. Now think about this. Brothers and sisters, think about who the instigators of this might have been. Do you know the order of the brothers? The order of the brothers was first Reuben, then Simeon, then Levi, then Judah. But we know this wasn't Reuben's idea. We're told that, aren't we? Verse 21. Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands, and said, let us not kill him. So it wasn't Reuben's idea, even though he was supposedly the firstborn. And it wasn't Judah's idea, because verse 26 says, Judah said unto his brethren, "What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." No, it wasn't Judah's idea. So who were the next brothers in order of seniority after Reuben and before Judah? And the answer is, why, Simeon and Levi. They were the oldest of the sons of the family. It increases the likelihood that these were they who in fact instigated this matter against Joseph. And by the time we come back to Genesis chapter 49, because Genesis chapter 49, of course, is Jacob's blessing right at the end of his life, long, long after all these events have unfolded to their fullness, Jacob knew exactly what had happened when he gave his prophecy according to the Spirit in the terms of Genesis chapter 49. So let's come back to Genesis 49 and see what it is now that Jacob says as this prophecy unfolds. So he says in verse 5 again, "Simeon and Levi are brethren." And you see what the margin says? "Their swords are weapons of violence." That's the swords they used in Genesis 34 to wreak vengeance, were they not? And then Jacob says, verse 6, "O my soul, come not thou into their secret. Unto their assembly, mine honour, be not thou united." And Jacob clearly recoils in horror from the dark deeds of these two sons. He sets himself apart from their plotting. And what were they plotting? Verse 6, "For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they digged down a wall." Now the question is, they slew a man, they digged down a wall. Now Adam Clark translates that phrase, "In their anger they slew a man, Shechem, and in their self-will they murdered a prince, Hamor," which is probably quite a useful idea in suggesting that there are two lines of prophecy to be fulfilled here that have a specific focus. But I think it misses what Jacob really says, because it's not what the Hebrew says. So you see what it says in the English? It says, "In their anger they slew a man," which is absolutely correct, "and in their self-will they digged down a wall." But the margin doesn't say "digged down a wall," does it? The margin says, "they hoofed oxen." Now I don't know whether you say huffed or hoffed or hocht. It's actually, I think the word's of Scottish derivation, to hoch, which means, of course, to hamstring the back tendons behind the heel so as to lame an animal. And in this particular case, I believe the margin, in fact, is correct for this reason, because, you see, here's the alternative translations and where they come from. The King James has digged down a wall because It's based upon this word here, shua, with a cholim above, below, sorry, the vav. Now there's the vav just there in the middle, and if you put a little dot at the bottom, that's a cholim, and when you put that dot below the vav, the word is shua, which means wall. And that's found in the Latin Vulgate, in a couple of the Targums, and in the Arabic text. But that's not what the Jewish Masoretic text has. The Jewish Masoretic text has the same word, but this time with a little cholim above the vav, which now means that the word is not shua, but sure. Did you notice the subtlety of that change there? It's almost indistinguishable, isn't it? But this time, the word no longer means wall, it means, well, it means ox. And that's how it's translated in the Septuagint, in the Samaritan text, and by Tyndale, by Greens, by a number of other translations, because the Masoretic pointing says that that's where the cholim should go, and the text signifies ox. And what I can tell you is that in every other place in the Old Testament where that word is ever used, it is always translated as ox. Oh, and just one more thing. The margin says hocht, oxen, but the word is in the singular. Just one ox. Just one single ox. They lamed an ox. And if slaying a man is a reference to the killing of Shechem, then we believe that hoffing an ox is an allusion to the laming of a man. But I don't think Jacob was talking about Hamor. I think he was talking about Joseph. And you see, it means to hamstring behind, by, as I say, by slicing the tendon behind the heel. Now, Jacob doesn't say who the ox was, but Moses does. Because if you come to Deuteronomy chapter 33, do you see what Moses says in his song at the end of the book of Deuteronomy? Deuteronomy chapter 33 says this in verse 17. He says, Deuteronomy 33, verse 17, verse 16 for connection, for the precious things of the earth and the fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush, let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph, and upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren. His glory is like the firstling of his bullock. But the New International Version translates the phrase as follows: in majesty he is like a firstborn bull. His horns are the horns of a wild ox. And the he of the verse is Joseph himself. Joseph is a bullock, says Moses in prophecy. Now you see that word bullock in Deuteronomy 33 in verse 17? That's the same word translated ox in Genesis 49 verse 6. And the firstborn ox belonged to Yahweh and was always offered in sacrifice to him. Yes, I think Joseph was the ox that they hoffed. They didn't slay him, but they destroyed his work and his role in the family through envy, and they crippled his status as effective firstborn son by selling him into captivity. And now we know why the Targum just describes Simeon and Levi as the ringleaders in the plot against Joseph in Genesis 37, because they were, and by the time Jacob uttered his prophecy in Genesis 49, he already knew what had transpired. So come back to Genesis 49 and see what it is that Jacob says as that little prophecy comes to a conclusion. So back in Genesis chapter 49, the record says this in the seventh verse. He says, "Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel." You know, there's a lesson here concerning friendship, isn't there? Some friends bring out the worst in others, and their friendship is not helpful in the truth at all. And these two were brethren, but they were brethren in crime. It's like the Diaglot translation of the 1st of Corinthians 15 and verse 33. "Be not deceived, evil companions corrupt virtuous habits." And so Jacob says in verse 7, I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And so Jacob's prophecy predicted that they would be divided and scattered so that their combined cruelty might never be brought together again to slay a man or hoof an ox. That was the cry of the prophecy of Jacob. Now the amazing thing is that that prophecy, as it turned out, was fulfilled in astonishing detail. But in its fulfillment, we have the lesson for our study tonight. And what that lesson is this. That whatever comes upon us in life, whether good or evil, whether just or unjust, whether blessing or cursing, our response will totally affect the outcome that occurs. We can choose to bow before God and submit to his chastening hand, or we can deny the truth, refuse to change, and pursue our own course. We're free to choose, because the principle of free will is one of God's divine axioms, is it not? But attached to it is the law of consequences that follows. So we wonder what impact that their father's words had on the two brothers. Well, shall we see what happened? Because he said two things, didn't he? I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Now, have a look at this divided in Jacob. If you come to Exodus chapter 32, you may recall that an event occurred pretty much at the start of the journeyings of Israel through the wilderness towards the promised land. And we're told in Exodus 32 these words, when it says that, well, you remember what it says in verse 5, when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it and made proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. So there was a matter of apostasy and immorality. And verse 26 says, Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, who is on Yahweh's side? Let him come unto me. And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together unto him. And he said unto them, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, put every man his sword by his side, and go in and out from gate to gate throughout the camp, and slay every man his brother, and every man his companion, and every man his neighbor. And the children of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and there fell of the people that day about 3,000 men. For Moses had said, consecrate yourselves today to Yahweh, even every man upon his son and upon his brother, that he may bestow a blessing upon you this day. And what we're told on this occasion is that men of Levi drew sword against men of Simeon on this day, and all because of the truth. In fact, it appears that Levi had probably stood aside from the whole episode to begin with, because verse 25 says, and when Moses saw that the people were naked, for Aaron had made them naked unto their shame among their enemies, and the margin says, among those that rose up against them, and those who would rise against them were none other than the tribe of Levi in obedience to the call of Moses. And you know, because of this episode, we're told, are we not, later on, because of their faithfulness, Levi were appointed to the priesthood and made separate from all the tribes in their dedication to Yahweh. And in standing for him and deciding to be on God's side, they declared that they would no longer be a brother to Simeon. In acts of wickedness and violence and evil, they stood instead for God. And Levi made choice. And that choice that Levi made had a consequence upon the outcome of how the blessing or the curse of Jacob would be fulfilled in their lives. And just as there was an episode at the start of the wilderness wanderings, you might remember that there was another one close to the end. Because in Numbers 25, we're told that as they had almost got to the promised land, another terrible and devastating episode occurred. It's in Numbers chapter 25. And the record says, in Numbers 25 and verse 1, Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods, and the people did eat and bowed down to their gods, and Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor, and the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel. We know that that anger resulted in a plague, a terrible plague, a plague in which 24,000 people died, says verse 9. But who intervened? Who acted? Who stopped the plague? Well, of course, the answer is verse 11. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, of the tribe of Levi, of course, hath turned my wrath away. Wherefore, verse 12, wherefore say, behold, I give unto him my covenant of peace, and he shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God. And that intense spirit that once was manifested in acts of violence had now been subdued and transformed into a spirit of earnest dedication to God's service. And when Phinehas stood up, it was to perform God's will and not his own. And who did he stand against on this day? Verse 14. Now the name of the Israelite that was slain, even that was slain with the Midianitess woman, was Zimri, the son of Salu, a prince of the chief house among the Simeonites. And a man of Levi slew a man of Simeon because of faithfulness to God. And if Phinehas was the leader of all that was honorable and good in being zealous for Yahweh's purpose in this chapter, Zimri was the leader of the whole apostasy and their tribe, and the plague was a disaster for them. This plague, I believe, in this chapter was a disaster for the tribe of Simeon. In fact, one of the reasons why we know that is, well, have a look at this. This is a comparison of the census at the beginning and the end of the wilderness journeys. And you'll see down here that at the start of the wilderness journeys, there was about 603,000 people in the tally. And by the end of the wilderness journeys, there's about 601,000. There's not a lot of change, really, is there? But look at this tribe. Who did the plague devastate in Numbers 25? I believe it devastated more than any other tribe, the tribe of Simeon, because they continued to follow their father in a spirit that was absolutely unholy. And you see, Jacob's words had come true, and the two tribes were divided, completely divided, before they'd even entered the land. And that division reflected the fact that one tribe still showed the same spirit as their father Simeon, whom Jacob had cursed, whilst the other tribe, Levi, had by their very faithfulness turned that same judgment to a blessing. But Jacob hadn't just said, had he, that I will divide them in Jacob. Did he not also say, I will scatter them in Israel? Well, see how that works out in Deuteronomy chapter 33. So in Deuteronomy 33, the record says this. Concerning Moses' blessing upon the tribes, a little later on, it says this of Levi. Deuteronomy 33 and verse 8 says, And of Levi he said, Let thy Thummim and thy Urim be with thy Holy One, whom thou didst prove at Massah, and with whom thou didst strive at the waters of Meribah, who said unto his father and to his mother, I have not seen him. Neither did he acknowledge his brethren, nor knew his own children. For they have observed thy word and kept thy covenant, and they shall teach Jacob thy judgments and Israel thy law. They, the Levites, shall put incense before thee and whole burnt sacrifice upon thine altar. Bless Yahweh, his substance. Accept the work of Levi's hands. Smite through the loins of them that rise against him and of them that hate him, that they rise not again. And in this prophecy we're told that Levi was indeed scattered in Israel, But God used that scattering in order to allow Levi, verse 10, to teach Jacob thy judgments and Israel thy law. And so a spiritual response brought about a dramatically different outcome. Because what we're told in a passage which we won't turn up in Numbers 35, you'll remember that the Levites were given cities. How many of them? 48. Scattered through every other tribe. They were scattered in Israel in fulfillment of the promise of Jacob's prophecy. And yet that scattering meant that the spiritual influence of the tribe of Levi was felt everywhere. And because of their own response, what could have been a curse, what could have been a judgment, turned out to be a marvelous blessing for the whole nation, because in the scattering of Levi, the spiritualness and faithfulness of that tribe was embedded into every other place, every other part, and every other tribe in the nation. Oh yes, this was a good scattering, as it turned out to be, but all because of their response, you see. But with Simeon, their scattering was different. Theirs was the outworking of Jacob's curse, and it appears that they did not learn, did not repent, and did not change. Because that devastation from the episode of Baal Peor that slashed the numbers of their tribe to less than half, in fact, do you know when Deuteronomy 33 records Moses' blessing on the tribes, he doesn't even mention Simeon at all. He strikes Simeon out of the record of the blessing of the tribes. And so restricted were they. Well, if you come to Joshua chapter 19, see what happens when they got into the land and they were awarded finally their chosen portions and inheritances. Joshua 19 in verse 1 tells us what happened to the inheritance of Simeon. And so devastated was this tribe in size, the record says this, verse 1. The second lot came forth to Simeon, even for the tribe of the children of Simeon, according to their families, and their inheritance was within the inheritance of the children of Judah. Their inheritance was where? Inside the inheritance of Judah. Now, what we're being told in Joshua 19 and verse 1 is that because Simeon were so diminished in numbers, in the end they were not given a separate piece of land at all. They were scattered inside the tribe of Judah. They had certain cities that were theirs, but that's all they got. And later on, if you come to the first of Chronicles in chapter 4, there was a later moment in the history of the nation when they were seeking to expand, and they did seek additional room. And when they did, just see the spirit of this tribe as they go about their business. First of Chronicles chapter 4 and verse 39. And see what happens here in terms of, well, see whether you can see the spirit of their father still at work in a tribe that will not change and that will not learn. 1 Chronicles chapter 4 and verse 39 says, and they went to the entrance of Gedor, even to the east side of the valley. This is about the house of Simeon, by the way, verse 24. They went to the entrance of Gedor, verse 39, to the east side of the valley, and they found fat pasture and good, and the land was wide and quiet and peaceable, for they of Ham had dwelt there of old. And these written by name came in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. And oh, guess what they did? They smote the tents and the habitations that were found there, and destroyed them utterly unto this day, and dwelt in their rooms, because there was pasture there for their flocks. And some of them, even of the sons of Simeon, 500 men, went to Mount Seir, having for their captains Pelatiah, and Neariah, and Rephaiah, and Uziel, the sons of Ishi, and they smote the rest of the Amalekites that were escaped and dwelt there unto this day. See the record, verse 41? Smote them. Verse 43, smote them. The swords of the tribe of Simeon are out again, wreaking vengeance and desolation while they destroy other people to make place for themselves. You think they've learned anything? This is the old spirit of the tribe, isn't it? From the swords that first flashed in Genesis 34. But you know, in this very matter of Simeon seeking increase for themselves as a tribe, they actually further fulfilled the very words of Jacob. Because now what happened was this: they were scattered even further apart. Some were in Judah, some were now further west in the area of Gedor, and some were now further east and south in the land of Edom. And what happened was that in their very endeavors to increase their holdings, they scattered the tribe further. And Jacob's words were fulfilled. In fact, you know what happened finally to the tribe of Simeon? It's a really amazing story, really, in terms of the prophecy of Jacob, because so decimated did the tribe of Simeon become that finally other tribes took pity on them and they asked them to perform a humble occupation. As far as the tribes were concerned, and they invited men of Simeon to come into all the tribes to fulfill this task. Now, I've got a quotation about this, which, well, it says this. It's from a commentary on Genesis, and it says, "As for the tribe of Simeon that had not a distinct part by itself in the land of Canaan, but lay scattered up and down," isn't that an interesting expression? "Lay scattered up and down in the tribe of Judah, and when they were increased and straitened for room, many of them went without the land to the entrance of Gedor, where they of Ham had dwelt, and others to Mount Seir in Edom." You see at the end of that, right at the end it says, "And what they became were teachers of children, by which they lived among several tribes." So the Simeonites became school teachers, and the other tribes invited them to come and teach their children. And when the tribes made those invitations, and they of Simeon responded, it ended up that the tribe of Simeon was scattered absolutely into all other parts of the land in fulfillment of Jacob's prophecy, you see. And we might imagine that there the story ends, with the two brothers divided and scattered to tread their separate paths according to how they responded. But that's not the end of the story. Actually, it's the beginning. Because you see, ask yourself this question: why was it that Simeon and Levi were brought together in the prophecy of their father? What was it, do you think, that Jacob really saw that caused him such horror and anguish that he recoiled and said, "Be not united, my soul, unto these boys"? Well, you see, what he'd said in Genesis 49, we don't need to go back to it, but what he said in Genesis 49 and verse 1, he said, "I will tell you what shall befall you in the last days." And that phrase, "the last days," suddenly takes us well beyond the life of the lads, does it not? To the time, indeed, of the overthrow of Judah's commonwealth in AD 70. And I think that what the old man saw was Simeon and Levi's spirit and the final hatred of the nation towards Messiah himself. And in the providence of God, Simeon and Levi were brought together again as brethren against the antitypical Joseph. Now, let me put that same quotation back up on the screen for you, but let me change the colour now so you see another little bit that I glossed over deliberately. So here it is. It says, actually, tribe of Simeon became scribes. Ah, now that's interesting, isn't it? The tribe of Simeon became scribes. And as we come into the New Testament record, we will find, well, in what gospel should we go, do you think, to look at the story of they who might turn against Joseph, whose symbol is the ox? What thinkest thou? Shall we have a look at Mark's gospel? Come and have a look at Mark in chapter 14. And see what the record says, because there's something peculiarly interesting about Mark's gospel in this particular record. We're going to come to Mark 14, and just before I do that, I'll just put this additional slide up as a commentary. It's actually from a man called Hippolytus in commentary upon Genesis chapter 49. It's rather interesting. He says, "Simeon and Levi, brethren, fulfilled iniquity of their own choice. Into their counsel let not my soul enter, and in their assembly let not my heart contend, for in their anger they slew men, and in their passion they hoffed a bull." This he says regarding the conspiracy into which they were to enter against the Lord. "Since from Simeon sprang the scribes, and from Levi the priests, for the scribes and priests fulfilled iniquity of their own choice, and with one mind they slew the Lord. And suddenly we realize that the prophecy of Jacob reached well beyond the story of Simeon and Levi in the Old Testament and comes directly into the New. You see what Mark 14, verse 1 says? It says, after 2 days was the feast of the Passover of unleavened bread, and the chief priests and scribes sought how they might take him by craft and put him to death. You see that? The chief priests and the scribes. In fact, when it says that they sought how they might do that, do you know what they really did? Matthew 26, verse 3 says, they assembled together in secret in the high priest's palace. And that's exactly what Jacob had said. O my soul, come not thou into their secret, unto their assembly, mine honour, be not thou united. And here it is in Mark 14, verse 1. The secret council, the hidden assembly of Simeon and Levi gathering together against the Lord's anointed, the latter-day Joseph. Now let me show you how that works in this particular gospel. It's, here it is. Mark 14, verse 1. The chief priests and the scribes. Mark 14, verse 43, the chief priests and the scribes. Verse 53, the priests and the scribes. Chapter 15, verse 1, the priests and the scribes. Chapter 15, verse 31, the chief priests mocking said among themselves with the scribes. And peculiarly and uniquely and significantly and especially, have I said enough words there, brothers and sisters? In this gospel of all gospels, the gospel of the ox, the chief priests and the scribes will be seen to collaborate together against the Lord in this gospel. What an astonishing thing to see how, in fact, that was going to play out. And of course, they won, didn't they, brothers and sisters? In the end, they won because they crucified the Lord. They crucified him. As a result of these two brothers coming together in the New Testament record, what an astonishing outworking of divine things. Do you know that if you have a look at the foot in terms of how crucifixion occurs, you know, traditionally we see the depiction of a crucified man with nails placed right through the middle of the feet, do we not? Nailed to the cross through the sort of front of the feet. I don't think that's how it happened. The only evidence that's ever been discovered in the land of Israel concerning crucifixion showed, in fact, a nail being put in through the side of the foot. And the reason why that was so is because of this, is because there just happens to be a spot just there between the calcaneus and the talus and the cuboid bones where there's a little hole. And if you drive a nail through there, you can pin a man to a cross. But if you do, you won't break the bone. That was a matter of biblical requirement, wasn't it? No bone be broken. But if you drive a nail through that hole, what you also do is you affect the nerves. And there are principal nerves in that place which, if ruptured, bring about terrible pain. And not only nerves, but arteries, because there is a lateral artery that runs directly over the area of that gap, which if you sever that artery, there is again tremendous pain. And not only that, but tendons, because there is a particular tendon here that comes right down over that very spot where that hole in the bones exists. And not only the tendons, but the muscles, because directly under that spot there is a muscle called the quadratus plantae, and in fact, if you sever that, if you pierce that, well, let me tell you what happens to the location of pain. If you attack the quadratus plantar muscle in any way, and if you put a nail through it, what happens is it produces, the muscle's actually here, but it produces terrible, indescribable pain, and you'd never guess where the pain is. It's in the heel. And I think when all that happened, brothers and sisters, when the joints were forced and the bones were separated and the nerve was punctured and the artery was severed and the tendon was ruptured and the muscle was pierced, there came about the fulfillment of Bible prophecy. And the Lord said, they pierced my feet. And Genesis 49 said, they halved an ox. And Genesis chapter 3 said, thou shalt bruise his heel. And all of this was outworked, you see, in the story of the death of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, what's interesting is, do you know that that's all based so much more closely than we could ever imagine on the story of Joseph, whom Simeon and Levi had dealt so unkindly against. In fact, if you just come back to that psalm, Psalm 105, Psalm 105 comments on the story of Joseph as he went into Egypt. I want you to see the only thing that the Bible says about the harm and about the ill and about the sufferings that came upon Joseph. Here's the divine commentary on the sufferings of Joseph. Why were those words used, hoft and ox, in Genesis 49, to describe the evil done to Joseph by his brethren? We see what it says in Psalm 105 and verse 17. He sent a man before them, even Joseph, who was sold for a servant. And then it says, and it's the only thing that it ever says, about all the anguish and all the sufferings and all the privations that Joseph endured, the only thing recorded by the Spirit is, they hurt his feet. They hurt his feet. And whatever happened, we don't know because we're not told. There were perhaps either scars or a permanent limp that Joseph had as a result of something they did to hurt his feet whilst in prison. And when Jacob met Joseph in Egypt much later before he died, he saw those feet. And he saw either the scars or the limp. And he knew the full story of what Simeon and Levi had done to his son Joseph. And in that prophecy says, in their cruelty they hoofed an ox, because he knew what had happened to Joseph. And all of this became a foreshadowing of the crucifixion of our Lord Jesus Christ. What an amazing way in which this prophecy turned to be outworked. And yet the spirit of Joseph was, well, verse 17 really, in the end Joseph believed and Joseph said to his brethren that God had sent him before them in order that a good outcome might belong to all the family. So here's the lesson as we come to the moment now of thinking about this particular story and its implication for us in our lives. And the lesson, you see, is this, that we all have events in our lives, some of which are of our own making and some of which come through no fault of our own but through the actions of others. And it's so easy to claim that the outcome is the result of the event, but that's never the case. And the story of Simeon and Levi teaches us that what we do in between the event and the outcome can change the outcome. We can either blame and justify and excuse or deny, or we can repent and confess and surrender and change. But you see, the really interesting thing is that once we've made a response to either choose the right or, in the case of failure, to confront our wrong, once we've made that first response, it becomes so much harder to change. It's as if the die is cast, and our subsequent actions in either direction seem only to widen the gulf further. Isn't that the lesson of these two brothers? That right at the start, they made two totally different choices as to how they would respond to their father's words. And that single choice at the beginning leads to an ever-widening gulf, you see. Now, a man once said this. He said, between stimulus and response, there is space. In that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. That man was Viktor Frankl, Holocaust survivor, who wrote as a result of his experiences in the concentration camps in Europe that he knew that that space, that vital little space between what happens and how we respond, is the critical moment when we either go forward or backwards in terms of the outcomes of our lives. See, we can never go back and shape a better past. Sometimes we wish we could, but we can always use the present to shape a better future. And the key principle to remember when next we're faced with a crisis is that the thinking of the flesh prompts us to react to the event, but the thinking of the Spirit prompts us to respond to the outcome. Shall I just put that on the screen? Because I think it's worthy of thought. And that's this. That, you see, I think there's two different things here. There's always an event and there's always an outcome. But, you see, we can either choose to react, which I think is instinctive, or we can choose to respond, which is measured. And there's a difference, perhaps, between those two words, don't you think? You see, one is the thinking of the flesh that prompts us to react to the past events. That was the life of Simeon. The other is the thinking of the Spirit that moves us to respond to future outcomes. That was the lesson of the life of Levi. And every time we're faced with a difficulty and a trial and a crisis, this is the choice that we're asked to make. This is the decision that we face. And so the lesson of these two, as to why they were blessed together, is so that they could choose how they might respond to the warning of God. They were guilty together of wrongdoing against Joseph, but based on their spirit subsequently, God could either bless or curse them, and God can do the same in our lives. And what we need to learn is that our reaction or our response will always affect the outcome. Such as the story, don't you think, of these two sons of Jacob, as their father's prophecy was so astonishingly outworked in the subsequent history of the nation and of the tribe and eventually of the people themselves into the New Testament record. And of course, the greatest example of that principle at work is the Lord himself. You see, Christ was overcome by events through no fault of his own, but he chose to respond, always chose to respond to the one outcome that shaped his entire life, and that outcome always was, "Thy will be done." So Christ is everywhere in the Bible, isn't he? And he's certainly here in this story, don't you think? Thanks be to God, who in this story of the blessing of Simeon and Levi would conceal the work of his son, the cruelty of his enemies, the mode of his death, the piercing of his feet, the power of his forgiveness, and even of his final exaltation. Because Psalm 105 says of Joseph, "The king sent and loosed him and let him go free." And Acts 2 says of Messiah, "Whom God raised up, having loosed the pains of death." Oh yes, the story of Joseph would be outworked in the life of Jesus. Jesus is our Joseph. So let's remember, after every event, before we do anything, to take a breath, to find the space to choose, and to seek to not react, but to respond. And let's make choice not to react to the events of the past, but to respond to the outcomes of the future, and to be inspired by the example of one who confronts us with the spirit of his response and the wonder of his life in the lessons of our Lord. As it says, brothers and sisters, in a hymn, "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride. See from his head his hands, his feet, sorrow and love flow mingled down. Did e'er such love and sorrow meet? Or thorns compose so rich a crown? Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all."